Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Min Chen. Boaz Devere is an American-Israeli award-winning filmmaker. His upcoming documentary, Cojot, tells the unknown story of Michel Cojot, a Frenchman who played a pivotal role in a 1976 hostage rescue mission. Previously, Devere was a journalist and editor based in Florida. He now teaches documentary filmmaking and multimedia storytelling at Penn State's College of Communications. Boaz Devere, welcome to Take Note.
Thank you, Min. Great to be here.
Your new documentary film, Cojot, is in post-production, and it's about a Frenchman and Holocaust survivor, Michel Cojot, who set out to kill his father's Nazi executioner but failed, and later found a way to redeem himself during a hostage rescue operation. But you didn't plan to tell his story originally. How did you come across the name of Michel Cojot?
It was an obscure name. I'd never heard of it, but I knew Operation Entebbe very well. I grew up with it. I was a kid in Israel when it happened. But then, of course, later on, I read about it. I wrote about it for several newspapers. It was of great interest. And when I was teaching in France, I had the opportunity to do an Entebbe project. My intention originally was to do it on a man who I had grown up believing was the French hero of that operation. That's what I was told. That's what all of us were told, that this certain guy was the hero. And in interviewing him, I started to have doubts just because I've done many interviews in my life and I knew the story so well and things didn't add up. There were gaps, there were issues, and I started to doubt whether or not he was a hero. I decided to stick with the project just to see where it takes me. And the following year, when I went back to France again to teach, again, I did interviews, but this time I interviewed others who were there, hostages, co-pilots, that sort of sourcing. And a different name came up, a different name completely, one I'd never heard of, Michel Cojot. I was told this is the real unsung hero of the operation. And that really intrigued me, and I started to study him and research him, and lo and behold, realized he deserved more than just a short documentary. He really deserves probably an encyclopedia. He's so complex, but I'm doing a feature-length documentary about him that includes his whole journey. He saw Operation Entebbe as his chance of redemption. Well, the film shows why. Why did he see it as his chance at redemption? Why was it a second chance? So for that, you have to see the film, and it builds up to not necessarily a climax, but more of an answer, I feel, at some point about his opportunity to redeem himself.
You have later said that allowing the story to alter your project is worthwhile. For this project, what is the story?
You want me to tell you the whole story? I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, happy to. So Michel Cojot is a banker. And he seems to live a great life. He has three adorable children. He's married to a beautiful woman. He travels the world. He does really well as a management consultant. Seems relatively happy, but he's not. He's broken. He's broken for two reasons. One is that when he was 4 years old, his dad left and never came back. And it took Michel 30 years to figure out what happened to him even. And that is in itself, you know, a problem when you need so much time just to figure out what happened to your dad. And it takes you forever to figure out what happened. And then you realize that what happened is terrible. And that is that the father died at Auschwitz. By the way, as a side note, it seems based on the research that I've done that his father didn't just die at Auschwitz, was actually also experimented on. Thankfully, I don't think Michel ever discovered that. But he knew that his dad died. So that's the first thing. And the second is that, as incredible as it sounds to us, he regrets not going with him, which is really, you know, when you stand aside and look at it, you were 4 years old. What do you mean? What could you have done? You couldn't have protected your dad from the Nazis. The only thing that will have happened is Michel will have died. There's no other consequence to him going with his dad. And yet he regrets not going with him. He's tormented by this. He dreams about it. He thinks about it. He feels guilty about it his whole life. So in the 1970s, he gets what seems to be some sort of an opportunity to resolve that issue. When he learns that a man named Klaus Altman may be former Nazi officer Klaus Altman. And the reason this is important to Michel is because Klaus Barbie is the Nazi officer who deported his dad to Auschwitz. So he's thinking, if Klaus Altman, living freely in Bolivia, may be Klaus Barbie, maybe I can do something here. And he researches further and he realizes, wait, you know, this guy, Klaus Altman, is free and happy and working for the Bolivian government. And France has tried to extradite him several times and failed and has given up. So he's secure. And he researches Klaus Barbie further. And he learns that this Nazi, when he finished, you know, his duty as a Nazi in World War II, took on a new role, a new interrogation torture role. And that was for the CIA. And the CIA helped him get to Bolivia, where he is safe. The French, meanwhile, besides trying to extradite Klaus Barbie, also, in addition to that, tried Klaus Barbie in absentia. They held court without him there. They did it twice. They found him guilty twice and sentenced him to death twice. So with all of that combined, Michel Cogeau concludes that he needs to carry out that sentence. And he relocates his family to South America, to Caracas. And he goes to Bolivia twice. He goes on a reconnaissance mission, initially to map things out, see where Klaus Altman is, see if there's a resemblance between Klaus Altman and Klaus Barbie, which he concludes there is, talk to people, make his way into Klaus Altman's group, and then he comes back. And this time he comes back with a pistol that he bought in Mexico in 1975, and he pretends to be a journalist, which is a lie. He's not a journalist. He has a fake press card. And he gets introduced to Klaus Altman and gets an interview with Klaus Altman. And during this interview, he gets Klaus Altman to admit that he is Klaus Barbie and to be unapologetic about what he did. He makes excuses, etc. But the bottom line is, this is Klaus Barbie and he's unrepentant. So Michel knows he's got the right guy and he believes he deserves to die. So the next day, Michel dons a poncho, a Bolivian poncho, so he can blend in. And he grips his pistol underneath it. It's raining. And he follows Klaus Altman, that is really Klaus Barbie, through the streets, which are windy and also hilly streets of La Paz. And at some point, he gets him right in front of him. And he takes out the pistol. And he knows that all he has to do is shoot. But he hesitates. He starts to think, if I shoot, do I become as bad as the Nazis? The right thing to do? Does this really make up for the death of his dad? All these thoughts race to his head. And he lets Klaus Barbie go.
And you said that, I think, at this point, he feels like he has failed his father a second time.
Exactly. He can't really bring himself to kill this guy. Even though he was a monster during the Holocaust and kind of a notorious figure, he's really kind of an unimpressive human being at this point. And Michel just doesn't muster up enough anger and rage to pull the trigger. So at that particular moment, obviously, it seems like the right decision. But as he walks away, as he returns to Caracas, he starts to have grave doubts about his decision. And as you pointed out, the main reason for those doubts is the guilt. The guilt that still resides in him over not joining his dad when he was 4 years old to Auschwitz. And somehow thinking maybe if I'd shot him, maybe that guilt would be expunged or maybe I'd make my dad proud or whatever it is, right? And all of which makes no sense, but does to him and makes him even more depressed than he was before he set out to kill Barbie. To compound his issues, his wife leaves him. She's gone. She divorces him. She takes the kids. They return to France. He keeps his job, but he loses everything else. And he becomes suicidal. After not shooting Klaus, Michel's right hand, with which he gripped the pistol, becomes paralyzed. He can't use it. And he sees doctors all over the world until he finally goes to see a psychologist. And the psychologist says to him, have you thought about the Psalms verse that says, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand be crippled. So Michel, who grew up not knowing he was Jewish, he had pretended to be a Christian in order to survive the Holocaust, realized, okay, maybe my right hand is pointing me somewhere. So he decides that what he needs to do now is turn his attention away from Klaus, turn his attention away from his trouble. And in the summer of 1976, he goes to Israel and does volunteer consulting. He brings along his boss with him. He kind of drags his boss along also to do this work and brings along his 12-year-old son. On the flight back, they get hijacked. They get hijacked by two German terrorists and two Palestinian terrorists. needless to say that everybody's panicking, right? If you're on a plane and you're suddenly hijacked and there's 250 of them, they'll panic, they're screaming, they're upset. Only one guy thinks this is a good thing, Michel. He immediately sees this as yet another chance to redeem himself, to make his dad proud. He figures, okay, now I can do something that's clearly the right thing and not have to worry about it later. Did I? Didn't I? It's clearer what he needs to do.
I want to mention that Misha Kojo, or Misha Kojo Goldberg, died in 1999. He later changed his name back to reflect both of his father and his stepfather's name. Was it difficult for you to gather all the pieces to tell a story of someone whom you've never met? How do you approach doing that?
No, that's a great point, Min. I'm doing a profile in a sense, right? I'm portraying someone, and I've never met him. I've never filmed him. It is difficult. So my strategy is not just to tell his story. I don't think that's enough. I don't think it's enough for me to gather all the facts and get all the, you know, even visuals that go with it. That's okay. That's the basics. But what I really need to do is channel him, figure out a way to channel him, in a sense, almost bring him back to life for the 80 minutes that the film lasts. And the way to do it is mostly through the people who knew him, so that they're not just giving opinions about him or reciting facts, but they're really channeling who he was. And that's why I take time in the film to give a multidimensional portrait of him. He was a complex man. You know, I can just focus on these two events. I can just focus on his hunt for Klaus Barbie and what he did in Operation Entebbe. That would be enough. That can make a whole film. But I take quite a bit of time to get into his psyche and his personality. You know, I have his family members in particular, but others who knew him, describe him, what he was like. And it wasn't always a pretty picture. This guy had his issues, as you might imagine. He was complicated. He was a very strict dad, for instance. His intentions were good. His intentions were to get his kids to be self-reliant, resilient, tough, so they could survive, just like he had to survive. So they could be independent, so they would never need anyone, right, in case something happened to him. And I think those are good intentions, but it didn't always come off, you know, as the best fathering or parenting. And some of the kids are resentful about how strict he was with them. And I think it's important for viewers to know that. And I think there's more to it than just, oh, okay, he was somewhat of a unsung hero, but even as a hero, he wasn't perfect. Yeah, you want to paint a multidimensional picture. I think sometimes we get caught in hero worship, and I think we have to get away with that from that. But beyond that, I think it shows us what happens when you survive a trauma, in this case, the Holocaust. What happens to your long term? What happens to your life? What happens to your happiness? What happens to your relationships? What happens to the way you look at things? It's a study of that too. And also, what happens to someone who doesn't know who they are? A lot of us, I think, are searching for meaning, but also figuring out our identities. And we're aware of situations in our community and beyond where some people don't feel too comfortable, you know, maybe either with their identity or in sharing their true identity. So here's a man who didn't know who he was, and as a result, he suffered. I think once he figured out his identity, he was much better. He was never happy. He never got over not joining his dad. He always felt guilty about that. But after he figured out his identity and, as you mentioned, added the name Goldberg back to his name, realized he was Jewish, went to Israel, became an unsung hero in Entebbe, he was on much more solid ground than he had been, much. And that made a big difference for him and I think for everyone around him.
You mentioned that he is a complex guy. There's a lot of problem, that a lot of issue that goes on in his life. Do you feel like from time to time you need to justify for the choices that he made? Because hunting down someone, trying to kill them, isn't really that glorious of a cause.
No, my job is not to really worry about how he's perceived. My job is to tell his story, to tell it accurately, to tell it fully, and to tell it in an engaging way. And my job is not to provide any answers at all. I don't believe that there are answers. My job is to raise questions in people's mind. And that's how I raise awareness. And then I think every viewer then can make up their own mind. And I can tell you, having screened or talked about this project with audiences now over the past year, let me think of the total number, probably well over 1,000 people, that it seems that there are about 1,000 different points of view on it so far. You can slice and dice the story in many, many different ways and walk away with different conclusions. Also, I've noticed in talking to certain people about this over the years that some people's opinions change as time goes on. They might say one thing now and then think about it differently later. So that's the beauty of the story, that there isn't like one answer, one right or wrong. It's really up to the viewer to draw their own conclusion.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Boaz Devier, an assistant professor at Penn State. We're talking to him about his upcoming documentary, Kojol. There seems to be a lot of different facets of the story. Kojol struggled with coming to terms with his anger and pain of losing his father at a really young age. He has this internal battle for justice, and eventually he embraces Jewish identity. How do you, as a filmmaker, show all of these different things in one story?
That's probably the biggest challenge of this project, and that is knowing what I have to include, knowing what I need to leave out, and then figuring out how to tie things together. It's a challenge. It's a bigger challenge than any project I've ever had before, honestly. You could almost see that this could be two different films. But if it were, it wouldn't be as satisfying. So it's something I'm grappling with, figuring out how do I tie it together. And of course, you know, one of the issues is if I do a little too much of this, then it drags. But if I don't do enough, then it's unclear. So I have to, you know, now I'm really beginning to, because up to now it's really just rough of putting everything together, throwing it on the wall, see what sticks. But moving forward, I really start to fine-tune that, you know. I have to hit the sweet spot where there's just enough that it doesn't drag, but it's clear, right? So where is that point? I don't know yet. But as I play with it, hopefully I'll arrive at that. And then I'll do another screening and test it and see if it resonates properly.
There are actually quite a few documentaries, movies, and even a 1988 arcade game called Operation Thunderbolt depicting this exact hijack and rescue Operation Entebbe. But your documentary is the first time people will learn from the perspective of Michel Kojol. And what does that mean to you to look at this story from an angle that people haven't heard before?
Yeah, I know about that arcade game. There's books, there's movies, there's TV series, there's a whole bunch of stuff on Operation Entebbe. My job is not at all to retell the story of Entebbe. My job is to introduce a new character to the world stage, a character who's been there but we didn't know about, Michel Kojol.
Kojol's journey to embrace his Jewish identity is very unique. He went through all this dramatic experience in his life. How do you think people could resonate with that and see something about themselves in Kojol's story?
You know, I share my stories, my projects with my students. I give students opportunities to work on my projects. I bring them into the classroom. I talk about them. Of course, you know, I think it's useful for students to hear what their professors are actually doing, you know, professionally. I would say my students get excited about these projects and love these stories. I tell the stories of ordinary people who go through extraordinary circumstances and as a result transform into game changers, into trailblazers. Sometimes you might call them heroes. So that's consistent. And those kind of people are engaging. You know, my students love to hear about them. And they always react favorably in the sense that they want to hear more. When it comes to Michel Kojol, I'm seeing something else. I'm seeing the kind of enthusiasm that's at a whole other level. They are not just thrilled to hear a story, they are thirsty to hear more. And they want to connect and they want to work on this project and they love the idea of learning about someone who I think in many ways mirrors what they're going through. What I'm seeing among students these days is a real quest for meaning. And ultimately, that's what Michel is doing. He's trying to figure out where can I make a difference? Where can I do something that means something? And they relate to that. They relate to that very strongly, right along with this whole notion of who am I? Who am I? Why am I here? You know, what is my purpose? In that sense, he can be inspirational to them because he shows them that you can be, you know, broken. You can have problems, even mental issues, you could say that he really had, right? And still come out of it, not just strong, but having made a big difference in the world.
Speaking of educational efforts, you teach at Penn State, and there are a lot of students involved in this project. And full disclosure, we have worked together before. I helped with the project, A Wing and a Prayer.
Yes.
Good times.
You did a good job.
Thank you. And you really encourage students to take important roles in your projects. Why is that?
So I've been teaching now for 14 years. I was at the University of Florida before coming to Penn State, been at Penn State for 4 years. I've been making films for 10. But even before I started making films, it was always vital to me to give students hands-on experience. I think it's crucial. So when I started making documentaries, I thought I need to give my students an opportunity to work with me on my documentaries. And I did. And any student who wanted to do an independent study, an internship, whatever they wanted could come, work in any different aspects of the filmmaking that benefited them. And filmmaking is vast, so there's many opportunities. So there's never a need for a student to do something that I want them to do. It's just, come on, join us. What would you like to do? Okay, well, you can do that. We got that, right? You want to take still photos? Good. Come take still photos, you know? You want to do graphic design? Come, design the poster. You know, there's tons of things to do. Initially, in the first few years, these were just exercises. The students mostly did work for themselves to learn. I didn't use it. I didn't use the posters that they created. I didn't put the work in the film mostly, right? There were a few exceptions, of course. Well, that has started to change, I would say, with Cujot. Cujot is really the first project where student work is prominent. All the music that's in Cujot, even though I came up with the melodies, I composed it, all of it is recorded by Penn State students, arranged by Penn State students, engineered by Penn State students, and played by Penn State musicians, as an example. So it's changing, right? In the past, the music I did before was not played by student musicians. I did it with professional musicians. So I think it's this generation. I just think they're more capable than we were. I think they're getting better and better. I really do. And a lot of the graphic design in the film is by students and so forth and so on. So it's exciting. I'm still continuing to give students an opportunity to gain hands-on experience for their own benefit. But now it's also starting to actually benefit the film too, which is fun.
Judd Nelson, known for playing John Bender in The Breakfast Club, narrates this documentary. What made you decide that he should be the voice of the story, and how do you work together on narration?
So I mentioned a film I made called A Wing and a Prayer. And I had Billy Baldwin. The actor Billy Baldwin happens to be Alec Baldwin's brother, but he's an actor on his own. He has a great voice. He does a wonderful job. He narrated A Wing and a Prayer. I hadn't met Billy Baldwin on another project. When I met Billy Baldwin, I also met a producer named Steve Whitney. Steve Whitney ended up being an associate producer on A Wing and a Prayer. We became friends. A couple of days after we signed Billy Baldwin, I get a call from Steve, and Steve says that he had run into Judd Nelson at a party, and they got caught up, and he told them about The Wing and a Prayer, and Judd just loved the story and wanted to talk to me about it. I said, great. We got on the phone, and Judd was just so impressive because he had done his homework, he did his research, he had great questions, great ideas, and I had to tell Judd, listen, you know, we already have Billy, we signed him up, so there's no opportunity here for you to do voiceover. But I said, Judd, I have another project for you. That's when I told him about Cujot. And he just lit up. He loved it. He couldn't believe it. He said, is this real? Is this actually real? Did this happen? And he just immediately said, yes, absolutely, I will narrate it. And I was so impressed with his passion and his thinking around, you know, the storytelling, that I thought, wow, not only can he do a great job because he has a great voice and a great personality, not only can he do a great job narrating, but he would be a great partner in telling the story. And he has been. Whereas in the past, when I've written narrations, yes, we tweak it here and there for language when we are in the recording studio. But mostly, I mean, what I write is what is read. With Judd, it's not like that. You know, we sit and go through every sentence and he challenges me and we tear it apart and I have to rewrite it and send it to him again until it's just right. So he's a wonderful partner, in particular when dealing with a story this complex.
You're American-Israeli, and I believe your grandfather was a Holocaust survivor. And I wonder, how does that identity influence you and your work, especially in telling the story of Kozho, which has so much to do with the implications of Holocaust and Jewish identity?
The Holocaust is an opportunity. The Holocaust is an opportunity for us to learn extremely valuable lessons and make the world a better place for everyone. That's the number one thing I think we need to understand about the Holocaust. There's two big issues with that. Number one, I don't believe we're learning the right lessons. Number two, I don't think enough of us are even bothering to learn anything at all. A new study came out the same day we had the screening on April 12th, which happened to be Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. And it said that, I think if I'm correct, it was 4 out of 10. I think it was exactly 42% of millennials don't know what the Holocaust is. Nearly half of the millennials don't really know what the Holocaust is. And I've had students come to my office for various reasons to talk about different things. I'm not sure how it came up, but whenever the Holocaust comes up, you know, I ask, what do you know about it? And I've had students say to me, to be honest, very little, or I've never heard of it before. So we need to teach the Holocaust. And we need to, besides teaching it, realize that it's an opportunity for us to teach valuable lessons, current, timely lessons that can mean something to us today. It's not just a history lesson. It's not just an obligation. It's a chance to really learn something so valuable about how we should treat each other and how we should pay attention to what goes on around us, right? And so I try to do that. I try to keep that in mind. I had obviously four grandparents, but two of my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And one of them, my grandmother, was the only survivor of that side of the family. And she really didn't survive. She kind of survived. She was in Auschwitz, but she was very sick and depressed her whole life and died in her early 50s as a result. So, you know, it's something that is with me, but it's not about just telling my story or my family story. It really is about helping others gain something from it. And I think the best way to gain something from it is to tell engaging stories, and not the typical stories. That's why I look for these kind of stories that are post-Holocaust. What did Holocaust survivors do after the Holocaust, for instance? To me, that's even more interesting than what happened during the Holocaust. And I think it's more relatable to us. That's why I seek out these stories.
Do you see your story as an effort to keep this really important part of history relevant for the generation to come?
Definitely. Definitely that, yes. Making it timely and relevant, making it contemporary, absolutely. So that, again, it doesn't just feel like an obligation. Oh, yeah, I need to learn about the Holocaust. I'm going to sit here and just watch this and then walk away from it and check off that box. No, I want it to be something that resonates, that people can relate to on a personal level. And even though this is a rough cut and needs tons of work, I need to spend months on it now. Based on the feedback I'm getting, and it's overwhelming, by the way. I really have not been able to do much other than deal with the feedback for the last week. It just really, and it's, I'm humbled by it. The feedback tells me so far that at least this type of story for sure can bring the Holocaust into a contemporary type of engagement.
Thank you so much for joining us, Boaz.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Boaz Devier is an award-winning filmmaker and an assistant professor at Penn State. He talked to us about his upcoming documentary, Kozho. You can listen to more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take-note. I'm Min Xian, WPSU.